The shooting of two Gardaí yesterday evening in the Whitechapel area of Blanchardstown in West Dublin is major front page news this morning. The Irish Times carries a photograph on page one of an armed Garda at the scene, while the report below describes how a man was arrested last night after what the paper describes as an armed siege, during which two Gardaí were shot and injured. The paper says the injuries are non-life-threatening and were inflicted with an automatic weapon. The stories on the front of the Irish Sun and the Irish Daily Star, which both carry dramatic images taken at the scene yesterday evening, Gardaí blasted, is the headline for the Star. Elsewhere on the Irish Times front page, the story that the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council has warned the government that its budgetary forecasts lack credibility and are inconsistent with spending commitments. It's on the front of the Irish Independent too, which reports that while the economy is ready to bounce back quickly from COVID-19, the budget watchdog has warned that the government's medium-term plans to deal with the financial fallout are poor. The Fiscal Council predicts strong growth will return as restrictions ease and vaccines are rolled out, but it's sounding the alarm on ongoing spending commitments from government following 2 years of large deficits to cope with the pandemic, and it cautions against repeating the mistakes of the boom. The reopening of hospitality and the delay in releasing the guidelines are on page 3 of the Irish Examiner. Elaine Loughlin and Daniel McConnell report that while most of the Fáilte Ireland guidelines on indoor dining have been approved by government, it's understood the rules around the number of people who can gather has become a sticking point. They write that Fáilte Ireland had put forward a limit of 6 adults per table, but government officials have been going back and forth on the number of children who could also be present. Meanwhile, the Irish Daily Mail leads on no vaccine bonus for dining out, reporting that it's emerged there will be no special dining rules for fully vaccinated people. And elsewhere on page 3 of the Examiner, publicans and restaurateurs from Limerick and Cork express their confusion and frustration when it comes to planning for the big reopening. Brian Kenny, who runs the Boothouse Bar in Glanmire in Cork with his wife Louise, said certainty and clarity was essential at this point because, he said, the cost of opening, closing and reopening is immense. It takes a huge toll financially and mentally. And in her column in the Mail, Fiona Looney reflects on the fact that for many, the return to the old normal will not be easy. She writes that being one of the many thousands who lost a loved one during this awful time doesn't help with navigating a way out of it. For so many of us, there can never be a return to our old lives because there are huge important parts of it missing. But she adds, there are other forms of grief as well. Grief for lost opportunities, personally and professionally. For all those milestones that were experienced through screens, for friendships and relationships we might have made, and for all those conversations we might have had that didn't include the C word.
Two Gardaí shot and wounded in a Dublin suburb. We'll be hearing what happened.
If you have a TV, you must have a TV licence. It's the law. Make your payments easy with yearly, twice yearly, quarterly or monthly direct debits. See tvlicense.ie for more. Your TV licence, made easier. Brought to you by the Government of Ireland.
It's time to move out of diesel. So make the move to Toyota and our incredible range of self-charging hybrid electric cars. With contributions of up to €3,000, join the thousands of hybrid drivers enjoying lower taxes and cleaner air. You'll never take a wrong turn with Toyota, Ireland's best-selling car brand. Visit your dealer or search Toyota Hybrid. Toyota. Built for a better world. Terms and conditions apply. Best-selling car brand this year based on most recent published monthly figures.
After last year, you're probably 93% sure you need a kitchen and bathroom refresh, 87% sure you want a garden revamp, and crucially 99% sure you'll be welcoming guests again soon. Good thing the Tile Style sale has 40% off almost all tiles and 20% off bathrooms and wood flooring. That's incredible savings on the latest collections, including Porcelainosa and Cars of Sweden. So you'll be 100% happy with your home. Shop in-store or online at tilestyle.ie. Terms and conditions apply.
You're with Morning Ireland at 13 minutes past 7. A man is in custody this morning following a shooting incident in Dublin during which two Gardaí were injured. Events began to unfold in Whitechapel Grove in Blanchardstown just after 7:30 last night. It's understood the Gardaí had called to a house and shots were fired at them. They were hit in the leg and arm and treated at the scene before being brought to Connolly Memorial Hospital. After several hours of negotiation, the man with the firearm agreed to come out of his house. He was arrested and is being detained at Blanchardstown Garda Station. He's well known to Gardaí for involvement in serious crime. After midnight, Chief Superintendent Finbar Murphy and Superintendent Peter Burke addressed the media. Among them are crime correspondent Paul Reynolds about the night's events.
Earlier this evening, Tuesday evening, shortly after 7 p.m, Whitechapel Grove, Gardaí responded to a call of an armed incident. On arrival at the incident, Gardaí were driving around to see what was after occurring, and they came under fire from a house. The Gardaí got out of the car, took cover behind the car, but in doing so, two of the Gardaí were injured. One of the guards was shot in the hand and the foot. Members called for assistance, and shortly afterwards, our armed support units arrived at the scene. We then brought our members away from the scene, the members who had been shot, and a barricade incident occurred that lasted for approximately 2.5 hours. During that time, we used our hostage or our negotiators to speak to the gunman, and shortly after 9:30 p.m. two guns were thrown from the house, and then shortly after that, a male left the house, surrendered himself. He was arrested and he's brought to Blanchardstown Garda Station, where he's currently in custody.
Do you know why this started? And there are reports that a woman was being threatened or injured.
It's too early in the investigation to indicate the cause of it.
But was there anybody else injured, or was there a woman in the house? Or
Peter, I'm going to hand over to Peter, who was up at the scene this evening.
Yeah.
Yes, I confirmed there was nobody else injured bar the two Garda members tonight. That was it.
And was the man in the house on his own during the time?
He was.
On his own? There was nobody else in the house with him?
Not, we believe, at this point, no.
So it just seems that they were fired upon for no reason.
Well, there's an investigation. You'll appreciate it's the early stages and it's just started, so that will come out during the course of the investigation.
So can you tell us how the Gardaí are?
The Gardaí are both in the hospital at the moment. As I said, they both have suffered shot injuries to the hand and to their feet. They're okay, non-life-threatening injuries. They're with their families at the moment.
Can you tell us how many shots were fired during this incident? I know there was an exchange of fire.
There was an exchange of fire, yes, the guards were fired on. The number of shots, I don't know at this point. It will come out as part of the investigation.
This is a very dangerous incident. It happened in the community. There was a lot of children around. There was families. It's a bright summer evening. Can you describe what the scene was like, how you had to cordon off a large area, and how you managed to keep other people safe?
Well, the Gardaí put in place their operation plan for a situation like this, and we set up an inner cordon and an outer cordon, and we evacuated a number of houses in the area just to maintain the public safety. And again, we'd like to thank the public for their cooperation tonight. They were very appreciative and very thankful and cooperative with the help they gave us.
There was a soccer club and children, a lot of children were playing soccer across the road. They heard the shooting.
There was a soccer pitch across the road from it, all right, and the children were moved into a place of safety and we evacuated them afterwards. And again, to the team and the managers up there, again, we thank them for their assistance during that incident.
And what would you say to, say, parents and members of the community who are worried about that? Can you give them any reassurance?
Absolutely. The Gardaí of Blanchardstown will continue to maintain a good presence up there. We'll be up there again tomorrow. We have a great relationship with the community in Blanchardstown, and we will maintain that over the coming days and into the future. One guard was injured on his hand and foot, and the second guard was injured just to his foot.
Well, there was a media blackout, and this was respected by the national media and newspapers. There was a lot of videos and information posted on social media. Did that cause problems for your investigation? Could it cause problems for you while you're in the middle of a live incident?
Well, the world we live in now, people upload videos very quickly on that, and that's something that we have to live with when it happens. And what we do want to do is to thank the mainstream media who stood by the blackout and didn't, you know, cooperated fully with us. And that's really important from our point of view. The other end of it is out of our control somewhat, but we do want to thank the mainstream media for their support.
Is there a case for approaching the social media companies in relation to this?
I wouldn't comment on that just now.
Chief Superintendent Finbar Murphy and Superintendent Peter Burke talking late last night to reporters, including our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds. We'll have more later, by the way, including how members of that soccer club, boys and girls aged from 9 to 11, were forced to take shelter in a nearby community hall.
A video has been released of Sofia Sapega, the woman who was arrested along with Belarusian journalist Roman Pratosevich on a Ryanair flight bound for Lithuania on Sunday. Sunday. The plane was diverted to the Belarusian capital Minsk after authorities there claimed there was a bomb on board. The move led to the European Union banning all flights over Belarusian airspace, as well as a number of other sanctions. The BBC's Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford has just arrived in Minsk. Flying from Russia is one of the few ways of getting into the country at the moment.
Yeah, it is. And since these new EU sanctions started to kick in and Europe started banning Belavia, the Belarusian carrier, from flying to European capitals, and other countries started cancelling their flights in and over Belarus, it's become much harder to get here. It certainly feels more isolated in that sense. I mean, there are still countries flying, I think Turkey, for example, but certainly Russia, big brother Russia, the big backer of Alexander Lukashenko and his government, is still, of course, keeping open its airspace and its flights. So Russia and Belarus have a union state, so they're extremely close allies. And I don't think there's any chance that that particular route is going to be closed down.
There's a video of Sofia Sapega, who was arrested along with Roman Protasevich on Sunday. How did she seem in that video?
Extremely uncomfortable. She was saying one thing, but I think her body language and her face was saying quite another. I mean, Roman Protasevich had a similar video published, a supposed confession from custody. He was looking straight at camera and speaking quite plainly, if you like. But I think that Sophia, when she was speaking, was really, she looked like she was shifting in her seat. She was slightly rolling her eyes. And she looked like she was saying, look, I'm saying what I'm supposed to say, but this is not what I mean. And I think that message is coming across loud and clear. But what she was actually saying was very serious. She was incriminating herself in a criminal activity. She was saying that she'd been involved in publishing the personal data of Belarusian security officials on a Telegram channel. And I've spoken to her lawyer. He's had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, so he can't tell me any details of what exactly she's being charged with. But he did confirm that she's in the KGB prison here. The KGB's never been renamed in Belarus. And that she's been remanded in custody for 2 months. So a very serious situation for her, the girlfriend of Roman Protasevich, who was simply flying with him.
Is she a Russian citizen, Sarah?
She is, yes. She has a Russian passport. And so the Russian consul, we believe, or certainly someone from the Russian consul that we believe, has visited her. It's interesting, though, because, Russian state media initially was very impressed, if that's the right word, by what Alexander Lukashenko appears to have pulled off by diverting this plane and arresting this prominent dissident. But when they found out that a Russian citizen was also involved, there was this kind of sort of silence at first. But then, slightly surprisingly perhaps, some key figures in Russian state media have started to speak out for Sofia Sapega and to suggest that she needs help here. So I suspect that it might be one of the key topics, or one of the topics at least, of discussions between Alexander Lukashenko and Vladimir Putin when they're expected to meet at the end of this week in Sochi in Russia.
What is the mood there in Belarus?
Nervous. More than that, I'd say scared, afraid. There's the kind of the Belarus that you see through the window, you see in the streets, that you feel when you walk around here, which is quite relaxed and quite normal, quite calm. You know, people are out and about. There's last night we were on the embankment of the river. There were people singing with guitars. There were a bunch of young rappers practicing on a stage that had been left up on the central square there. So, you know, it seems normal. But when you talk to people, political activists, people who are involved or were involved in the opposition here, they are really, really afraid. I've never felt anything quite like that here. And you know, Belarus has been an unfree place for many years, but still this is another level. So people are saying that they just don't know who could be next. And that's why they're worried to speak out, worried certainly to be involved actively in the opposition anymore. And there's just so many people behind bars, and those who aren't behind bars, the most prominent people, are now outside the country.
Well, I was going to say, all those protests that we saw almost every day, certainly every week in the months following last year's election, have they all stopped?
They have, yeah. It's just too dangerous. People just don't go out anymore. I mean, they were huge. There were massive protests right across the country. For months and months, every weekend, people were coming out. And And the Telegram channel Nechta, which Roman Protasevich originally was involved with, were kind of fundamental in keeping the momentum alive and motivating people and publishing videos from these tiny far-flung corners of the country and saying, look what's happening. People are opposed, even in these places, and openly opposed to Alexander Lukashenko after more than a quarter of a century of his rule. And so that was kind of central in terms of what was happening here. But these days, people, you know, the red and white flags that people were hanging out of their windows, the red and white clothes people were wearing, the sort of small pickets of people even standing in the streets, you know, daring to come out and defy the authorities, is just not happening anymore because it is literally just too dangerous.
And Sarah, you are the BBC's Moscow correspondent. You know that country very well. You describe Russia as Lukashenko's big backer. Will he be in any way nervous, Putin, about the heat that this has brought on to the region, Lithuania centrally involved, a NATO member?
No, I don't think so. I mean, Belarus has been supported, backed by Russia quite obviously and quite prominently in this crisis. And I think that's a deliberate choice. I think, you know, Vladimir Putin has always seen Belarus as a bit of a buffer between Russia and the EU and NATO. But I don't think he needs it in that sense. I think he needs Belarus to stay on side. He needs Belarus to be part of Russia's orbit. And with Alexander Lukashenko, although he's unpredictable and although things here are not ideal in terms of Russia's preferences, I think, you know, at this point, better the devil you know than certainly a different Belarus which might pivot towards Europe.
I was talking there to the BBC's Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford, who has just arrived in the Belarusian capital, Minsk.
Former chief advisor Dominic Cummings is likely to return to the headlines today when he gives evidence before a Westminster committee which is examining Britain's response to COVID-19. During the early months of the pandemic, he was still in Downing Street. However, relations with his former boss have since been severed, and in advance of his appearance, Mr. Cummings has set out his thinking in a 64-post Twitter thread. For more, we're joined by the political editor of the Financial Times, George Parker. George, what sort of questions is he likely to face this morning?
Well, he'll be asked about his own role in Downing Street. I mean, this rather a curious state of affairs. This is someone who was right at the heart of government. He was in the room for all the key meetings. He'll have documents. He may even have voice recordings of Boris Johnson talking about the handling of COVID-19. And I guess people will be asking Dominic Cummings, well, you were in there. Why didn't you do something about this chaos you're describing in your Twitter feed? And of course, he himself will face questions about, you know, the fact that he broke the lockdown rules with his famous trip to Barnard Castle, allegedly to test his eyesight, you know, when he's now posing as the biggest advocate of a lockdown strategy. So those are some of the questions for Dominic Cummings. But I think at the end of the day, there'll be more questions for Boris Johnson.
He was widely seen, as you say, as one of the most powerful people in government. Yet in his recent statements, it's like he's trying to recast himself almost as a bystander.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, I think that's the way that people will portray this inside Downing Street, that he's an embittered former employee trying to rewrite history so he comes out a bit better. And we do know that Dominic Cummings rewrote his blog to make it look like he saw coronavirus coming over the horizon. So he's someone who has previously rewritten history. But nevertheless, I suspect he will have copious proof to make some of his points. And in the past, when he's appeared before MPs, he's waved pieces of paper around. So, you know, that's how Number 10 will try to discredit what he's got to say. But I mean, it's certainly true that in the period Dominic Cummings was in Number 10, a number of very serious mistakes were made by the government. So MPs will want to hear from him about why they were made and his own account of them.
Already he's been having his say. He says the plan to tackle coronavirus was supposed to be world class, but turned out to be part disaster, part non-existent. What else has he been saying?
Yes, well, he said that initially the government was bent on a policy of herd immunity, which he said would lead to hundreds of thousands of people choking to death in hospitals. So he claims that the government was too slow to lock down the country back in March 2020, the first lockdown. And also, he will make the claim that Boris Johnson was ignoring scientific advice, ignoring the advice of Dominic Cummings, to lock the country down again in the autumn. And in fact, it only happened in November, and that more lives were lost as a result of the Prime Minister delaying. Again, there's going to be a whole load of questions I suspect that he will raise about the government's planning on testing, which was an absolute shambles. The way that the country didn't have enough protective equipment for medical staff, I think that's another big area. And I guess one of the more damaging things will be if he suggests that Boris Johnson took a callous approach to what was going on. And we've already heard from Dominic Cummings via intermediaries that the Prime Minister said he would be happy to see bodies piling up rather than introduce a third lockdown. So there's quite a lot for Dominic Cummings to get his tips in.
And it's been rumoured, it's been suggested that he might have tapes. Tell us about that.
Well, this is, Dominic Cummings often talks to a certain number of newspapers through alleged allies, and one of the allies has been suggesting that Dominic Cummings might have tape recordings of things the Prime Minister said. It's quite interesting, normally when people leave positions of power in the UK and in Ireland, I'm sure they're governed by certain rules, codes, even the law. Dominic Cummings, the rules don't seem to apply to him. So if he has evidence, I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's presented. And I think hearing the Prime Minister saying stuff about the early days of COVID, I suspect could have a certain shock factor if indeed he possesses these tapes. We don't know, of course.
The vaccination programme appears to have restored Boris Johnson's fortunes to a certain extent. I mean, he had that big by-election victory a couple of weeks ago. Could he be damaged today?
He could be. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Downing Street is very worried about what Dominic Cummings would say. It's very unusual, as I said, to have someone who's in the room for all the key meetings willing to go public and with such an axe to grind, and he's out to destroy Boris Johnson. So who wouldn't be worried about that? On the other hand, you know, these are events that happened last year. The public have generally accepted that the government made serious mistakes in the first 9 months of the handling of the pandemic. But the big but is that Boris Johnson got it right on that spectacular bet he made on acquiring vaccines before the EU did, for example. And the country is now very well down the road of towards full adult vaccination. So, you know, I think I've mentioned this thing before, that Downing Street clings to this idea that with a trauma, you remember how you came out of it rather than how you went into it. And I think that is the twin hope in Downing Street. First of all, that Dominic Cummings is not a popular person in the country, and that he will be portrayed by them as an embittered former employee. And the second thing is, this all happened, you know, a year or so ago, and now the country's getting better.
George Parker, thanks for joining us this morning.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And at 24 minutes to eight, here with the sport is Darren Frehill. Morning, Darren.
Good morning, Rachel. We're going to start with your own county once again. I think this is the third morning in a row we've been talking about Clare.
Oh, Lord, if it's not one thing, it's the other at the moment. Wouldn't it be lovely to see them making headlines for things that actually happen on the pitch? But anyway.
Wouldn't it just. I'm going to bring our listeners up to speed, those who haven't really been tuned into this whole situation over the last few mornings. On Monday morning, we had Brian Lowen, the Clare manager, giving out that two of his Clare players were named as close contacts when they marked two Wexford players who tested positive for COVID. Yesterday, with the GAA, they came out and said they were satisfied the HSE made the call and that it wasn't Wexford players who named the Clare players. Well, Brian Lowen and Clare GAA have released a statement. They released it yesterday evening, and they are maintaining their story. They say that they have discussed it, and they've got this confirmed from a HSE official, Brian Lowen has, that the two Wexford players in question did name the Clare players. So Wexford obviously denying this was the case, and the story rumbles on. In terms of on the field, we do know that the game between Kilkenny and Wexford, it was postponed from last weekend because of the COVID cases. They're hoping it'll go ahead this Sunday, and it has to be given the all clear by the HSE. But once they do that, the game will go ahead at 3 o'clock on Sunday. And you know what? I'm looking forward to that game if it does go ahead. I'm looking forward to a couple of interviews after it as well. UEFA have opened disciplinary proceedings against Real Madrid, Barcelona and Juventus in connection to their involvement in the aborted European Super League. Those clubs were the only ones of the original 12 who have not subsequently renounced the competition and reaffirmed their commitment to UEFA. The big one tonight is the Europa League final. It's Manchester United against Villarreal, 8 o'clock start. A big one for both clubs. Bruno Fernandes, as we know, has been key to United's return to form, and some very interesting comments from him in the pre-game press conference. He says it's heavy to lift a club like Manchester United, but he hasn't done it alone.
I think who lift this club was every single player together. not me, from myself, because it's a such big club. It's heavy to leave this club by myself. Of course, I did really well. I know that. My numbers, everything, the performance. But this comes from the help of my teammates. They make me being better every day. They make me enjoy being a player every day. And they help me to have that kind of numbers, because it's not easy. Also, if I get a lot of penalties, they have to get the penalties for me sometimes. And my strikers, they do one against every defender in this league, and they can pass through them easily because the qualities they have. And so they help me with that. Of course, in the assist I have, they help me with the movements, they help me with the finishing they have, the quality on the finishing they have. So I know all that things, but I don't leave the club for myself. I have the support of my teammates and the trust of my teammates, and that what makes me doing better and better, because if they trust on me, I know I can help them.
More on that a little bit later on. The big race of the day yesterday in Ballinrobe was the Mayo National, and a great story behind it. Jockey Philip Enright, a late call-up to ride Agent Peru. Ricky Doyle had a fall earlier, stood down, but he went on to win it on the outsider, a memorable win. The trainer, Tom Gibney.
He's a tough little horse. He's a wayward little horse. He has a mind of his own, and but this year he's shown a bit of consistency that we haven't seen for a long time. So it's fantastic.
And it's great for the owners, a lovely pot to win.
It's brilliant for the owners. They've stuck with him through thick and thin. And, you know, there was a long time there we were wondering, would we ever get him back? We always knew he had the ability, running well, consistently well.
Dave Keane is speaking with Tom there. Finally, the Irish women's cricket team got back to winning ways against Scotland, won it by 61 runs in their T20 series.
The final round of cap negotiations begins today in Brussels. The policy reform will see a shift towards more environmentally friendly farming, we're told. We'll speak to the Agriculture Minister in a few minutes. But first, Amy Ní Riadh explains all, and her report begins with Una Duggan of Birdwatch Ireland.
What we would like to see is some common sense coming to the table, because right now what we're seeing in terms of a draft cap deal is an utter lack of ambition when it comes to protecting biodiversity and restoring it.
Una Duggan is Head of Advocacy at Birdwatch Ireland and Environmental Pillar Representative to the CAP Consultative Committee. The Common Agricultural Policy is worth €10.7 billion, which is aimed at supporting farmers and improving agricultural productivity in Ireland. Unlike previous CAPs, this one is expected to mainstream environmental action, as Barry Cassidy from the Farmers' Journal explains.
It will be quite significant for Irish farmers if they do manage to clinch a deal. It will essentially set out how farm payments are made from 2023 until 2027. And there are a number of key issues on the table there too. Money that's been traditionally used for income supports is being redirected to fund eco-schemes. And these essentially will see farmers rewarded to carry out environmental, climate and animal welfare-related measures.
However, it's not new money. It's a repackaging of funds that was traditionally wrapped up in direct payments to farmers. Negotiators will decide what portion of those direct payments worth €1.2 billion will be ring-fenced for so-called eco-schemes. It's likely to be between 20 and 30%, a move that the Irish Farmers Association says will be costly to its members. Tim Cullinan is president.
The threat is very serious. If you take a farmer on a high payment and low hectares, so a farmer with 40 hectares, he could lose anything up to 37 or 40% of his payment. And that's an absolute serious cut. And we have to ensure that our minister will fight on his back to ensure this doesn't happen.
As well as that, there's the issue of convergence. Internal convergence means that each country has to flatten out the direct payments. 19 countries in the EU have 100% convergence, meaning that every farmer gets the same amount of funding per hectare, regardless of the work they're doing. The European Parliament wants to impose 100% convergence on the remaining countries, including Ireland.
We have a very clear message sent to our minister that we want him to hold tight on 75% convergence, 20% on eco-schemes, and we want to ensure that our minister gets the maximum flexibility that we'll be able to develop schemes to ensure that we keep the maximum amount of money with productive farmers, farmers that are out there every day doing the work. We have to ensure that they are rewarded for what they're doing, and farmers that are going to take on higher environmental ambition, that they will also get rewarded for the work they're doing.
It's expected that we will have an update on the reform by Friday morning. According to Una Duggan, the change has been a long time coming.
If agriculture policy isn't supporting restoration of farmland bird populations, addressing our greenhouse gas emissions and declining water quality, then we are looking at, in 8 years' time, a very worrying situation in terms of trying to meet targets in all those areas. Recently, Birdwatch Ireland published research which showed that there's been a doubling of farmland birds added to the red list in the last 21 years. So this is extremely worrying, and it's an indicator that there's been a marked decline in the quality of our environment, and this has to be changed.
That was Una Duggan of Birdwatch Ireland, ending that report by Amy Nuria. Well, we are joined now by the Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue, who will be taking part in these talks in Brussels. Minister McConnellogue, will farmers' incomes be cut by at least 30% after these talks are over?
No, good morning, Audrey. And no, they won't be cut by 30%, but there is a significant change in relation to increased environmental ambition as part of this current cap. But the next two or three days will be really important in relation to finalising the CAP plan at European level, and we will then develop our own national CAP plan over the summer. But really central to how we go forward has to be ensuring that farm incomes are very central and supported as part of the CAP, because that's a key part of it. Obviously, the asks that are being made of farmers change and merge over time, and we're seeing increased environmental ambition in relation to this particular CAP. But I think farmers have shown and demonstrated that they have always, first and foremost, in terms of producing food, been very much aware and custodians of our environment, but increasingly so, and are willing to do more in relation to this. But what's really important, in my view, coming out of this CAP is that as farmers are asked to do more, they're also that there's income streams associated with that that ensures that farm families are sustainable, and ultimately that we continue to produce top quality healthy food, which we do really well and do really well internationally in terms of its sustainability. But alongside that as well, we see increased ambition in relation to environment, but one that actually can deliver in terms of income for farmers too.
But did your own department not produce figures recently which showed that incomes would be cut by at least 32% by 2023 and more again then by 2026?
No, overall, the EU CAP budget for the next 7 years is just slightly larger than what it was for the previous 7 years. And indeed, working with my party colleague, Minister Michael McGrath, in relation to our national budget for agriculture, food and the marine this year, we had delivered an 11% increase to ensure that many of the schemes that are in place can continue, and also indeed to deliver some new schemes. So, for example, the new REAP environmental scheme, which I launched recently and which was five times oversubscribed, and which is a forerunner to the new flagship agri-environmental scheme that will start from 2023 under the new CAP. Those initiatives have been supported by additional funds. Likewise, there's the commitment in the programme for government that between now and 2030, there will be €1.5 billion funding from the carbon tax proceeds towards funding an environmental scheme as well.
So what I think are these figures then that I'm reading this morning, produced by the Department of Agriculture within the last number of weeks, showing that a farmer with an income of 12,800 receiving €400 per hectare, their payment will be cut to 8,673 in 2023 and then further reduced to 7,462 3 years later.
So there is an issue in relation to convergence, where there's various payments to different farmers for the entitlements that they hold under the single payment scheme, and there's going to be changes required, and that is part of the next CAP. That will see some farmers' incomes go up and some farmers' incomes go down. My objective this week in Brussels is to ensure that in relation to the final CAP programme at European level, that it gives Ireland and myself as Minister, working with farmers across the country, the opportunity in terms of developing our own CAP plan to produce one which is reflective and of the needs of our national agricultural industry. And I will then be having a consultation over the summer with farmers across the country in terms of how we address the issue of convergence, for example. But this week, obviously, it will be decided at European level what the minimum requirements on us in relation to that will be. And then in terms of our own national plan, I'm committed to ensuring that that's one which actually puts farmers at the centre, which
is flexible enough to allow farmers at the centre. But you heard, sorry to interrupt, you heard Una Duggan there of Birdwatch Ireland saying that at the moment this draft CAP deal lacks any ambition to protect and restore biodiversity. Have you started working on our own eco plan? Because that's up to member states to devise their own.
We We have, Audrey, and I wouldn't agree with Una in relation to that at all. I think this is a very ambitious cap from the point of view of the environment, both at European level and indeed at national level. And what's really important to that is that, that farmers' incomes are also central to it as well. So while we'll be delivering more in relation to the environment and farmers are continuing to take a leadership role in relation to addressing issues such as biodiversity and reducing the carbon footprint of the food we produce, that alongside that, there is significant income streams for farmers to support them in doing that. And I think, okay, you know, farmers have shown that they're willing to step up to the mark in that regard, right, as long as there's a partnership approach taken to it. And I think we can achieve that increased ambition, everyone working together, and that's the way we have to go forward here.
I just want to ask you finally about the fishermen, because you know they are protesting off the Cork coast this morning. They say they are being strangled, their livelihoods are being strangled by quota cuts, Brexit, and the EU policing of their industry. What do you say to them this morning?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really important to recognise that coming out of Brexit, that the fishery sector is the sector that has been most impacted by the Brexit result and outcome in the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, because it will see between now and 2026 a 15% impact in relation to our national quota. Obviously, Brexit posed a massive threat to fisheries. A third of all the fish we catch was caught in British waters, so a no-deal scenario would have been quite disastrous for the sector. But that's not to take away at all from the fact that the outcome has impacted fisheries in a way that hasn't impacted other parts of the economy. And that's why, Audrey, I've established a task force bringing together all of the voices in the sector and representatives to advise the government on how we can invest in the sector in the time ahead, how we can mitigate the impact that's there, and also maximise what is a tremendous marine resource we have and a tremendous industry and sector that we have. But there's no doubt, and I fully recognise this, the challenge and pain that is there for the fishers in the short term, and I am working hand in hand and very closely with them in terms of trying to support them to deal with that.
Thank you very much indeed, and we'll hear from some of those fishermen a little bit later in the programme. Agriculture and Fisheries Minister Charlie McConnellogue.
Consumers and businesses are continuing to move away from cash and paper-based payments. That's according to new figures from Banking and Payments Federation Ireland. They show that ATM withdrawals dropped by 44% in the first 3 months of the year, while electronic payments continue to grow. Brian Hayes, Chief Executive of Banking and Payments Federation Ireland, joins us on the line. Brian, this cashless trend has been accelerated by the pandemic, but will it continue as people get back out and about again?
Well, good morning, Jill. I think, yes, it will continue. What we've seen before COVID was this kind of onward march of electronic and digital payments and the decline of cash and checks across the economy, and especially so in the banking and payment industry. The kind of acceleration of that change in the last 12 months has been extraordinary. So people are really voting with their fingertips in terms of using the banking apps. I am using online banking. I'm transacting at a business-to-business level all of their crucial transactions. I think it's also worth to say that the industry moved swiftly when it came to increasing the thresholds for contactless payments from €30 to €50. And as we've shown in our payment data for the first quarter of this year, that trend is continuing, especially so in the contactless area, but also in the terms of the volumes of the number of volumes of ATM and cash withdrawals down about 44%, and check usage down year on year by 26%. When you consider that in 2016, 47 million checks were issued in the economy, last year, just 4 years after 2016, that was down to 23 million, so it's halved. So that trend is continuing, I suspect, as the economy continues to reopen and as businesses continue to get back on their feet.
And is that drop in direct debits and check usage not, you know, due to the restrictions that have been in place?
Some of it is, and that was also evident in our figures. But I think that the bigger driver is towards people's choice and customers' choice of how they interact with their payment and their banking system. For instance, in a survey we recently did, 77% of bank customers use online and mobile banking to access services, as against 12% who are using direct branch services. So it's a combination of branches, you know, you actually using the facilities that the banks provide, apps, and of course call centers, so that people can transact their business. But I think what we're seeing right the way across the payment and banking area is this move to contactless. And that's very evident, not just in the figures we've seen in the last 12 months, but in the trend that was there before that.
Okay, if we take a broader look at the banking sector, what is the outlook for competition like, Brian, now that Ulster Bank is shutting down operations in the Republic and KBC is also making an exit?
Well, I think competition is still strong in the Irish banking sector. We've seen, obviously, consolidation taking place. Obviously, decisions will have to be taken in the next number of months and beyond as to how the sector will emerge. I think the sector faces obviously a lot of challenges, that's clear in terms of the environment we're working in, but also the broad European trust in terms of a European supervisory and regulatory system. But I think if you look at, say, the competition in the mortgage market, we have seven players within the mortgage market directly. We also have non-bank lenders. So within that market, you are seeing, as we've seen in recent weeks and months, people switching, using the opportunity of switching, but also using the opportunity of asking their lenders and banks for better rates and trying to negotiate better rates. That's taking place. That's a sign of competition. That's something we as an industry body really support and we encourage people to take up.
Okay, Brian Hayes, Chief Executive of Banking and Payments Federation Ireland, thanks for joining us.
The shooting of two Gardaí yesterday evening in the Whitechapel area of Blanchardstown in West Dublin is major front page news this morning. The Irish Times carries a photograph on page one of an armed Garda at the scene, while the report below says a man was arrested last night after what the paper describes as an armed siege during which two Gardaí were shot and injured. The paper says the injuries are non-life-threatening and were inflicted with an automatic weapon. The story is also on the front of the Irish Sun and the Irish Daily Star, which both carry dramatic images taken at the scene yesterday evening. Gardaí blasted is the headline for the Star. On its front page, the Irish Independent reports that while the economy is ready to bounce back quickly from COVID-19, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council has warned that the government's medium-term plans to deal with the financial fallout are poor. The budget watchdog predicts strong growth will return as restrictions ease and vaccines are rolled out, but it's sounding the alarm on ongoing spending commitments from government following 2 years of large deficits to cope with the pandemic, and it cautions against repeating the mistakes of the boom. State hits 2.5 million vaccinations earlier than expected is the lead headline for the Irish Times, above the story that the HSE is expected to outline the next phase of the government's vaccination programme tomorrow, which will see more than 400,000 shots a week administered in June. The paper also reports that Taoiseach Micheál Martin yesterday predicted the milestone of 2.5 million doses administered was expected to be reached by the end of the day. The reopening of hospitality and the delay in releasing the guidelines are on page 3 of the Irish Examiner. Elaine Loughlin and Daniel McConnell report that while most of the Fáilte Ireland guidelines on indoor dining have been approved by government, it's understood the rules around the number of people who can gather has become a sticking point. They write that Fáilte Ireland had put forward a limit of 6 adults per table, but government officials have been going back and forth on the number of children who could also be present. Meanwhile, the Irish Daily Mail leads on no vaccine bonus for dining out, reporting that it's emerged there will be no special dining rules for fully vaccinated people. And elsewhere, on page 3 of the Examiner, publicans and restaurateurs from Limerick and Cork express their confusion and frustration when it comes to planning for the big reopening. Brian Kenny, who runs the Boothouse Bar in Glanmire in Cork with his wife Louise, said certainty and clarity were essential at this point because, he said, the cost of opening, closing and reopening is immense and it takes a huge toll financially and mentally. The Irish News reports that a High Court hearing challenging the Secretary of State, Executive and Health Department failure to commission and fund abortion services in Northern Ireland begins today. The case has been taken by the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission and is supported by a woman who herself was affected by the lack of commissioning of services during the COVID-19 pandemic. And in the Irish Times, Carl O'Brien writes that the Oireachtas Committee on Education yesterday heard that overcautious parenting and increased use of social media appear to be damaging the mental health of young people. Seamus Mulconry, Secretary General of the Catholic Primary Schools Managers Association, cited an example of a school which recently stopped children running in the playground following a complaint from a parent whose child had fallen. We're bubble wrapping children when they're young and they're not getting access to the kind of experiences that test their limits to run or be a bit reckless and find out what works or doesn't work, he said, adding, that children will fall. If we stop them falling, it's not actually good for them.
A man is in custody this morning following a terrifying incident in which two Gardaí were shot and injured in Dublin's Blanchardstown. It's believed the Gardaí had called to the house when shots were fired at them. The scene was then sealed off while officers from the emergency response unit and experienced negotiators were brought in. The man surrendered peacefully sometime after 9 o'clock. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds joins us now on the line. Paul, will you bring us through the evening's events? What happened?
Yeah, Rachel, this began shortly after 7 o'clock last night. The Gardaí received a report that shots had been fired in the Whitechapel estate in Blanchardstown in West Dublin. They responded, among them two armed detectives. When they arrived in the area, they were fired on. Shots hit the patrol car. The Gardaí said they got out of the car, they took cover, there was an exchange of gunfire. Both Gardaí were shot and injured. The shots came from a house in Whitechapel Grove. The Gardaí say a man was firing shots at them from an upstairs bedroom. The area was sealed off with an immediate cordon around the house and then a subsequent outside larger cordon, cordoning off the larger area. The Gardaí say they put in place their critical incident response. This was now a barricade incident with an armed man in a house. An operational commander was appointed. The emergency response unit, armed support units, officers from the National Negotiators Unit arrived. The negotiators began a dialogue with the armed man and spoke to him for more than 2 hours. At around 9:30, the man agreed to surrender his weapons two loaded firearms were thrown out the window of the house, a revolver and a machine pistol. Shortly afterwards, a man appeared at the front door of the house. He was topless with his hands up. He walked down the driveway to the street where he complied with the Garda requests to first go down on his knees, then on his stomach, keeping his hands up. He was handcuffed, arrested, taken to Blanchardstown Garda station where he remains in custody this morning.
How were the injured guards this morning?
We're told they're in hospital and that they're comfortable. When the Gardaí set up a protective cordon and when the shooting started, the Gardaí, one of them was shot in the hand and foot, the other one was shot in the foot. They couldn't move from where they were, even though they had been shot straight away, until the cordon had been set up. And then Gardaí with shields arrived and they were able to escort them out while their colleagues carried the two men to ambulances a few hundred metres away. The injured Gardaí were treated at the scene. They were taken to Connolly Hospital. Their families were with them in hospital in the early hours of this morning. The Taoiseach, the Minister for Justice and the Garda Commissioner all paid tribute to their courage, wished them a rapid recovery. The Chief Superintendent in charge of the area, Chief Superintendent Finbar Murphy, spoke to us about the incident in the early hours of this morning.
Just in relation to our own members, I think tonight is a reminder to us how dangerous it is for our guards out there every day when they go to work and the job that they do. And I want to thank them on behalf of the organisation, but also on behalf of the community, for their work and the work that they do and the danger that they put themselves in to make our community safe. And that is on behalf of myself, the community and the Garda Síochána. I say well done to them tonight. Everybody that responded tonight did a brilliant job.
And these people who have families who are concerned about them?
And these people have families. They've gone to work today. They have somebody had to make a phone call today to tell them this happened. It's real life. It's tough. But it's very, very important that the community appreciate the work that these guards are doing and the level of risk that they put themselves on a daily basis to protect society.
Paul, there was a media blackout in place for much of the evening. Why was that?
Yeah, this went on for over 3 hours. The Gardaí requested a news blackout. It was respected by all conventional national media for the 3 hours while the incident continued. This is to avoid any potential aggravation of the situation. There have been incidents in the past where people in situations like this may have heard media reports, particularly broadcast reports. So the Gardaí always ask in cases like this that the media not report anything. And the news blackout was respected by all conventional media, by the newspapers, by the broadcasters for over 3 hours last night. Not, however, by social media. Pictures, videos, speculation, some and also mistaken and wrong information began to appear soon afterwards and continued right up. It was only after the area was declared safe, the man was in custody, that the Gardaí then gave a press conference in the early hours this morning explaining what had happened.
I know at one stage there were reports on social media that a woman, possibly the man's mother, was also in the house.
Yeah, and they were discounted by the Gardaí at that press conference. They said there was nobody else in the house. There was only one man in the house while the incident took place.
Paul, all of this happened in the early evening, you know, an early summer's evening when kids are out playing in a busy suburban housing estate. It must have been pretty scary for people in the area.
Yeah, it was. And a lot of residents were asked to leave their homes, particularly people living in houses close to where the incident took place. And they weren't allowed back into their houses for over 3 hours. Some people who had come home from work or had come home were stopped at the cordon and prevented from going into their houses. We spoke to people in t-shirts, light clothes, who stood at the edge of the cordon for over 3 hours as it got colder and colder last night. There was also a group of about 50 or 60 local children, under 9s, under 10s and under 11s from the Mountview Boys and Girls Soccer Club at their regular Tuesday night session last night across the road from where the incident took place. When the shooting started, they heard the shots, and the parents and the mentors responded by taking those children to safety, first into the bushes and then into a local community hall. We spoke to some people who were out of their homes, and we spoke to some of the parents and mentors of that soccer club at the scene last night.
Just when we were out training, just heard all the shots, and it was a bit scary. We just got all the kids in as soon as we could, but scary.
You're with the Mountain View Club, are you? You're one of the trainers, are you?
No, it was me some place.
You're some place, but you were there on the sideline at the time.
Yeah.
That must have been very shocking for you.
Well, yeah, we didn't know what the hell was happening, but scary.
And somebody said that you had to hide the kids in the bushes before you got to the community centre?
Over in the corner there.
Just explain to us, yeah.
So we got them in there, and when it calmed down, just ran them all into the club, you know, so that's what happens.
And how are the kids?
They're all right, yeah, kept them busy inside with the football and that, so all ends well, you know, so.
And how many kids?
Oh, jeez, there was loads of us. So there was a good few. There was training, you know, three or four different ages training, you know, so.
Yeah, you had under 9s, I think?
Yeah, under 9s and 11s, yeah.
So if you had four teams, you'd probably have about 60 or 70 kids?
Well, if you have 60, yeah, easily, yeah.
And how are you yourself after?
Still shaking.
I was worried about my daughter now, to be honest. She's in the house there on her own, so.
And what age is she?
She's 22 now, but she's still my baby. So basically, I was just more worried about her, and my phone was dead, and the usual when you need her.
And have you been able to talk to her?
Yeah, she's just spoke to me there 2 minutes ago. So that's about it.
And she's okay, and you're okay?
Yeah.
Jeez, I don't think anything around here has happened like that for a long time. Like, you know, shocked when I heard the news, just came down to see what was going on, you know, and nothing, as I said, has happened around here for a long time like this, like, so just total shock, like, you know.
All I know, like, I left my room, went out to have a walk, see what was happening. Next thing I'm locked out, wondering, can I get home to have me snacks?
So you've been out in a t-shirt, standing here for, what, 4 hours?
Yeah, it's a little past 7. It's like, I just came across the road to get my aunt. It's like, she was around here. Said she can't get her car.
And were you frightened?
No. Just normal thing.
You think this is a regular occurrence around here?
Regular enough that you're not bothered by it, but not so regular that you have to worry about it.
People in Whitechapel last night. Paul, what can you tell us about the man who's in custody?
Well, the man is well known to the Gardaí for his involvement in serious and organised crime in West Dublin for over 20 years. He first came to the Gardaí attention in his teens and in his 20s. Following the murder of the journalist Veronica Guerin in 1996, most of the established and major Dublin criminals fled the country to avoid CAB and the crackdown. This left a vacuum which was filled by younger, more volatile and dangerous criminals. It led to the emergence of a criminal gang in West Dublin in the late 90s who were known as the Westies. Now, two of their most senior members were subsequently murdered in Spain and their bodies later discovered buried under concrete in a car park. This man was involved with that criminal gang back then 20 years ago, and then the subsequent criminal gang that emerged. He's been before the courts on a number of occasions, has served time in prison. He's also a target of the Garda local and national units, but he's also a target for other organised criminal gangs and has survived a number of attacks on his life, including one where he was shot several times. He was recently served with a Garda information message warning him his life was in danger. He's been detained this morning under Section 30 of the Offences Against the State Act. He can be questioned for up to 3 days in Blanchardstown Garda Station.
Paul, thank you. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
We're going to talk now to Anne O'Connor, Chief Operations Officer with the HSE, about the ongoing impact of the cyber attack on healthcare here and when patients can expect to have their appointments rescheduled. Anne O'Connor, good morning.
Good morning, Audrey.
Have things gotten any better across our HSE hospitals this week?
Well, Audrey, we're 13 days into this now since the attack happened, and we have made some progress, albeit it's very site-specific. So we have seen developments in relation to the voluntary hospitals in terms of their systems. They work in a slightly different way to the HSE hospitals. In relation to the broader system, there's a couple of priorities that we've been working on for the last few days. One of those has been trying to reinstore just email access for people. So you'll know that our whole healthcare system is very dependent on communication between clinicians and with patients and families and then other providers of services, and that's been hugely impacted. So we are looking at how we can get staff back being able to communicate, and the progress in that is that as of last night people have been able to just plug in their devices. Now we have 80,000 devices across our system, so just plugging them in is the first step so that we can deploy some protection to those systems. But in terms of turning them on and connecting them to servers, we're a bit away from that. So we are still very compromised, and we know that in some of our statutory hospitals, for example in the West and the South, we're still very compromised in relation to, for example, radiotherapy and some of the very critical services that we rely on. Our laboratories are also still very compromised. Many of our labs are working at under 20% capacity, and they're not able to take samples in from GPs, for example. So we know that we have a lot of samples there that haven't been tested, and that's obviously a big concern and a very big risk for us.
Yeah, and can we go through some of the other areas perhaps and get a sense of the impact? Because last Thursday the HSE in your briefing said that outpatients was down by between 70 and 80%. What's the figure there at this point in time?
That will have come back in the East, in the voluntary hospitals, really only. So the problem we have in relation to outpatients or emergency care is the lack of access to patient records. So the big hospitals in Dublin, for example, St. James's, Beaumont, Vincent's, Talanau and the Mater, they have access to their records, and one or two other hospitals, but not very many. So if you present today, in effect, in one of those hospitals, you're going to have to be treated like a new patient. We won't be able to access anything that has happened with you before, your medications, your previous diagnostics. So that is in terms of outpatients. We really are prioritising people. And again, it's the non-voluntary. So the voluntaries, the big hospitals in Dublin are seeing, I suppose, a lot of their outpatient people now. But most of the other hospitals are not. And we have.
And do you have a figure on that at this point, Anne?
No, so we know that we were at, as you said, 70% impacted last week. We will only be slightly better than that, so probably only around 60%, as in we're probably only about 40% working. Now, in any given day, Audrey, we see 14,000 people in a normal day in our outpatients, so that's still very significant in terms of cancellations. We don't have numbers because we've no system for capturing that at the minute, so we're relying on sites just to report to us individually.
And what about inpatients? Because last week I think the figure was at 50% down.
That's right. And we have seen that really stay around there. Again, in relation to inpatients, we are admitting those who need to be admitted the most. The whole pathway for care is very, very different. So our clinical teams are having to work in very different ways. And we are bringing people in on the basis of their urgency. We know that in Dublin, those big hospitals, again, they provide some of our very specialist national services. So that's great. They can continue to see people. But in terms of bringing people in, the whole pathway to do that is very different. So even just the communication from a GP to a consultant to get somebody in, or sending someone to an emergency department. But our inpatient services, I mean, important to say that even with all of this, our health services are working, but it's a very different way of working, and people will be hugely impacted in terms of their time, in terms of even the questions we'll have to ask you if you present. We'll have to go back and ask you all sorts of things that you might feel that you've been asked 10 times already. So that whole experience is very different.
And Anne, those seriously ill with cancer, chemotherapy services last Thursday were down 50%, you said, but they were coming back. What's the number at this point?
We haven't improved hugely on that. We have had progress in relation to the St. Luke's Oncology Network. We now have St. Luke's itself and their sites in St. James's and Beaumont operational. We don't have the sites in Galway and Cork operational yet, and that is a huge concern for us. It's an absolute priority. We have made arrangements with some of the private hospitals in relation to that, and people are travelling from Galway to St. Luke's in Dublin, which, as you can imagine, is really not an ideal scenario for anybody. Our clinicians are very concerned about this, and of course families and anybody listening to me today who's waiting for that treatment or waiting for that appointment will be hugely concerned. So all I can say on that is that we are doing absolutely everything we can. We're hoping to make some progress there, particularly for the West and the South, over the coming day or two, but unfortunately that hasn't gone as easily as we had hoped.
And just a final question then, in terms of the impact on the publication of the vaccination data, the COVID-19 vaccines. When do you expect to be back publishing those daily numbers?
We have no system for doing that at the minute, so our whole system of communication, as I said, is down, and critically our feed in from GPs. So in terms of any information we can capture, that hasn't come back. Now, we're working on that, as I said, in terms of the communication. Our first and foremost priority has to be the most critical patient care and those systems. But we're doing a number of things in parallel, and we do need to be able to, I suppose, keep people informed in terms of where we're at with vaccinations. And at the moment, we are relying on that supply information as opposed to GPs being able to tell us who they've vaccinated. So again, it's a work in progress. It's being dealt with in terms of a priority, but it, probably in terms of, for example, radiotherapy in our laboratories, it mightn't be as urgent as those. But we are looking at that, and we know that the vaccinations are proceeding. Thankfully, they haven't been impacted in terms of this issue. But in terms of reporting, that's just a step away still.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Anne O'Connor, Chief Operations Officer with the HSE.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And at 8:36, it's good morning again to Darren.
Hello again, Audrey. Well, a professor of public health and an advisor to the New Zealand government believes the IOC should postpone the Olympic Games again. New Zealand, considered one of the global leaders when it comes to fighting the pandemic, and one of their leading experts, Professor Michael Barker, feels if the Games go ahead, even more lives will be lost.
If you look back historically, the Games have been suspended or cancelled twice before, in the First World War and then on two occasions in the Second World War. And at the moment, we are facing, obviously, we're at war with a global pandemic. So I think it is the right thing to do to postpone the Olympics for another year. From the athletes' point of view, this would be a tragedy not to be able to compete this year. I fully understand that. And so this is really the great decision that I think needs to be made by the International Olympic Committee and the government of Japan about how you balance up those competing forces. But I think ultimately the symbolism and the reality of having an event like this during the time of a global pandemic, it just does not make sense to have this event at the moment. Still running away from us in low-income countries, and there's some dire projections for how the pandemic may progress in low- and middle-income countries in Asia and Africa and South America in particular. So I hope those projections don't happen, but it is very grim for those countries. It's very hard to imagine them prioritising sending teams to the Olympics in these circumstances.
Professor Michael Barker speaking on New Zealand television a couple of hours ago. Now, the Europa League final takes place tonight as Manchester United face Villarreal. 8 o'clock start in Gdansk. Former Sheffield Wednesday player and RTÉ analyst Paul Curry joins me now. Paul, let's look at the Manchester United side of things first of all. How important is tonight for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer?
Yeah, it's a big one, Darren, and it's a big one in the grand scheme of things. And you think of all the progress that Solskjaer has made at Manchester United and finishing second in the league this season. He really does need to start winning trophies now to underline that progress that they have made. They go into tonight massive favourites. Villarreal have had an average enough season, finishing seventh in La Liga, and by no means, really pushing the top sides in Spain. But there's probably still question marks there, Darren. Harry Maguire is really struggling. He didn't train yesterday. And Manchester United without Maguire have not been the same team. They've not won as many games. And they've also conceded a lot more goals. So there's going to be huge pressure there on Twan Zabi or Eric Bailly and whoever comes in to fill that hole. So, they go in favourites, but it's by no means a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, Villarreal unbeaten in Europe this year across 14 games, 2 draws, 12 wins. And they've got a manager with pedigree as well, haven't they?
Yeah, Unai Emery, ex-Arsenal manager. He's won this competition 3 times. He actually won it 3 times in a row while he was at Sevilla. And you wouldn't put it past him making that a fourth. They're probably, like most Spanish teams, they're more dangerous, Darren, when they've got the ball and they're controlling possession and they're looking to exploit teams. And their strength is most definitely in the final third with Carlos Bacca, who was very prominent at Sevilla with Emery. And also Gerard Moreno, who's just been included in the Spanish European squad. So for people who don't typically watch them, look out for those two, and I've no doubt that they will go up against that Manchester United back four and try move them around and exploit some holes and create chances. And you know, with Spanish teams, that they're more than capable of doing that. From a Manchester United perspective, the frailties with Spanish teams are always at the back. They showed that against Granada and Sociedad early on in the season. Your big players in the big games, you want Bruno, you want Pogba, Cavani and Rashford, that's how I see them lining up. You want them to come to the fore tonight, Darren. If Manchester United are going to win the game, I think they're going to have to score twice given the frailties at the back. But given everything that's gone on this season, the progress they've made, you would surely have to fancy Manchester United tonight.
Good talking to you, Paul. Enjoy the game in rugby. The Rainbow Cup returns this weekend, and the clash of the weekend, believe it or not, is that of Connacht and Treviso. The Italians didn't win a single game this season in the Pro 14 and are unbeaten, however, in the new competition. Big one for Roscommon native Dennis Buckley as well. He will earn his 200th cap. Michael Corcoran has been reminding him of a letter he wrote as a kid to the then manager, John Fallon, asking if he could be mascot at one of their games. He remembers it well.
I remember that well. Eric was captain actually that day, and then it was like I obviously walked out with him the day. I can't remember what age I was now. It was a long time ago. I imagine I was very young. But yeah, look, I was a big rugby fan from a really young age, and obviously as being from Connacht, I ended up being a big Connacht fan from a young age. And yeah, no, John, well, from La Hinch from years ago, and our parents are good friends. So yeah. Became a mascot for one of the games and got to walk out with the team and go to one of the Connacht games, and it was a pretty big occasion at the time. Yeah, and I was a big Connacht fan before that, and an even bigger one after it.
And I mean, that journey's lasted a head of a long time, and as William has been talking about, I mean, it's a lot of it an Italian kind of connection to it. But you know, given the fact where they are and where you are right now, this is almost like a sprint to the finish, isn't it? These games, you know, because there's actually so few of them.
Not every team plays each other, so it's quite unusual. Like, we know that we need to win. We know that if we get two wins, we're in a great position, but it still is a little bit out of our hands. But you can't really look that far ahead. All we can do is try and win this weekend, try and get 5 points, but let's get the win first and go from there.
Huge win for them. Must win. 5:15 on Saturday. Looking forward to it. That's all your sport for now.
The body which monitors the government's management of the economy has warned that its budgetary forecasts are poorly founded and lack credibility. In its new report, the Irish Fiscal Advisory Council, or IFAC, says that while the economy will bounce back from the pandemic, the government hasn't taken existing spending commitments into account. Sebastian Barnes chairs IFAC, and he joins us now on the line. Good morning.
Good morning.
It sounds as though you're worried.
Yeah, I think we are concerned. Obviously, there's good news on the economy, and that's welcome, and that will naturally also improve the public finances in the years ahead. But we're really worried about and concerned on the planning side. So there are really two concerns. One is the forecast that the government has put out. It's good they've put out medium-term forecasts, but they're not well-founded, and it basically doesn't provide a very realistic picture of what would happen, even if you just carry current policies on for the next couple of years. They're not factoring in the full cost of aging and inflation and these kinds of things. So there's a bit of a difference there. So while they show that they expect there to be, you know, the budget to be about balanced by 2025, we'd expect a deficit of around 1.2% of GNI start. It's not a huge difference, but it is significant, and it could mean that some adjustment measures are needed in the years ahead. But also the sort of bigger failing really is that the government hasn't really explained how it's going to prioritize the big things over the next couple of years. There are going to be big challenges around climate change, which could be very costly to meet. There's also they're implementing the Sláintecare care healthcare reform. That's a very major reform. And the government hasn't said how much those things are going to cost or how it's going to fund them.
You also express concern about the impact of changes to corporation tax. Is there a danger that the government is repeating the mistakes of the boom here and relying on a tax that won't last forever?
So this has been a long-standing concern of the council. About 1 in 6 euros of tax revenue is coming from corporation tax, and a lot of that is coming from a small number of very international companies that could easily move that money elsewhere. Now, we've seen that the Biden administration is planning big reforms in the US. That could have a real impact here in Ireland. The Department of Finance has built that into its forecast. It's assuming that you know, 2 billion in corporation tax will be lost through that source. There's a lot lot of uncertainty, but our view is that probably it would be more prudent to assume that more is going to be lost over the next 5 years. Maybe $3.5 billion will be lost, and the government needs to plan for that. And we're actually suggesting that they should also start to put some of that money, if it doesn't go straight away, into the rainy day fund, so that gradually we can wean the public finances off this dependency on this source of revenue that may not be there in 5 years' time.
Will tax rises of one form or another be necessary in your assessment?
So just to get the budget to balance, there may need to be some fiscal measures taken, but the real challenge is going to be to finance, particularly the measures needed to tackle climate change and some of the programme for government measures, particularly Sláintecha Care. So in that context, the government always has a choice between whether it wants to raise tax or whether it wants to find, you know, a sort of extra money through cutting spending elsewhere. But to be honest, I think it's pretty likely that taxes will need to increase in the years ahead.
Sebastian Barnes, thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland. Going straight away to some breaking news. Planning permission for a 179 apartment complex on the grounds of the former mother and baby home at Bessborough in Cork has been rejected by On Board Planála. The application by developers MWB2 Limited was the subject of an oral hearing. Our reporter Sinead Spain joins us in studio. Sinead, will you remind us of the background to all of this? Because it's a long story.
It is a long story. And as you say, Bessborough is a former mother and baby home. And in this planning application, MWB2 Limited wanted to build 179 apartments in three apartment blocks, ranging in height from 5 to 7 stories. So it was a significant development that was planned on the site. And the survivors of the mother and baby homes opposed the plans, claiming that those three blocks would overlap with an area which is marked on some historic maps as a children's burial ground. Now, if we go back to the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes, that previously heard evidence that there were 923 children born or associated with Bessborough who died between 1922 and the closure of the home in 1998. And at the time of its investigation, the Commission couldn't find burial records, or they could only find burial records for just 64 infants. And that prompted a campaign group, Cork Survivors and Supporters Alliance, to call for a proper examination of the Bessborough grounds. And it was really on that basis that they opposed this planning application.
And the appeal went to an oral hearing.
It did. It went to On Board Planála. And in a decision today, which was circulated to all of the parties who made submissions at that hearing, the board says that it's not satisfied that the site was not previously used as and does not contain a children's burial ground. It finds that there are reasonable concerns that the site could contain a burial ground, and that in that context it would be premature to grant permission for such a development without establishing those facts on whether there is a burial ground located on the site and also the extent of that burial ground. So it's on this grounds that they say the proposed development would be contrary to the proper planning and development of the sustainable development of the area.
Sinead, thanks indeed for joining us with that. More no doubt throughout the day.
Well, we're staying in Cork and going there next because a fishermen's protest, as we've been hearing, is taking place there this morning. We can join our southern editor, Pascal Sheehy. Pascal.
Good morning, Audrey. And we are in Cork Harbour. We're approaching, we have passed Passage West and we are approaching Blackrock Castle. And there is a flotilla of more than 50 fishing trawlers behind me here. I'm on board the Ronan Ross. It's a 37-metre trawler which fishes for tuna, mackerel and herring, and its owner, skipper John D. O'Sullivan from Castletown Bear, is one of my guests this morning. Also with us is Dina Busher from Kilmore Quay in County Wexford. Dina's trawler, the Ellie Ove, sank just over a month ago at the mouth of Kenmare Bay. And finally with me is Joe McGuinness from Castletown Bear, skipper of Blue Horizon, a 22-metre freezer trawler which fishes for whitefish and prawns on the Porcupine Bank. It's beautiful sunshine here this morning, but we're not here to enjoy the sunshine. We're here for a protest. Joe McGuinness, what are you protesting about? What are your problems?
Our main problem is lack of quota. We're not getting the quota in this country that we should be getting, considering the amount of area of fishing ground that we have. And it's very frustrating when you see French and Spanish vessels fishing beside you that have 10 times the quota you have. that should by right be ours, and it's terribly frustrating.
But these problems are long-standing. Have they become worse in recent times?
Without a doubt. Every year the quota is cut. The last 10 years it's just come down every year. And they're saying it's scientific, but there seems to be more fish now off the coast than ever there was. But we're just not allowed to catch it. We get a monthly quota, which it's not enough to keep boats viable. So we're struggling. We're really struggling.
Dina Busher, I was saying your trawler sank at the mouth of Kenmare Bay just over a month ago. Describe your situation to me now.
We're still in trouble. We still owe money. I can't help but think that if we were a Spanish or French registered trawler, that we wouldn't have been in as much debt as we are now, because we would have had plenty of quota, and any debts that we had would have been cleared. My family, we're struggling, and we're so sad to see our trawler gone. Standing here today and watching all the trawlers behind the Ronan Ross, we're proud to see it, but I still feel that sadness, and I really miss her.
Is there a future for you in this industry?
I don't see how there can be. I don't see how I could possibly go to the bank in the morning and ask for a loan to buy another trawler. Not with the way things are. It's just the government really has to do something for our fishermen, support us, give us the quota that we need to survive. They talk about the fish being endangered, but really it's the fishermen that are the endangered species here in Ireland.
John D. O'Sullivan, can you describe your situation to me and the problems that you're experiencing?
Well, we have a 37-metre vessel that fishes purely for pelagic fishing. We're finding it very hard in the last 10 years. The horse mackerel quota has gone down, and with Brexit now we have lost over 110,000 worth of quota, which is a major loss to our fishing vessel and to all the vessels that are the fishing that fish mackerel, the 50 vessels that fish mackerel off our coast. It's terrible though to lose such quota to the UK, because before this the UK had 40% of the fish in its own waters. The EU came along and gave 42 million out of Ireland's turnover of Ireland's fishing industry to the UK, 42 million out of coastal communities in Ireland, to give to the UK, which they now have 75% of the fish in their own waters, while Ireland have only 15%. We are only allowed to catch 1.5 fish out of every 10 in our waters.
Industry has contributed to its own problems.
The industry looks after itself. We have to look after the fish, we have to look after the stocks. We want to make sure that there's fish stocks there for future generations.
Unfortunately, time is against us. We are steaming to the docks in Cork City Centre, where a rally will take place later, and a letter with the fishermen's demands will be delivered to the office of the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin. But for now, from Cork Harbour, as we approach the city's docks, it's back to you in Dublin.
Pascal, thank you very much. Pascal Sheehy, live there in Cork. Dehumanising, outdated, just two words used in a new report to describe Ireland's methadone programme. There are currently around 10,000 people on methadone here, which is prescribed to help them stay off opioids like heroin. Well, one methadone user from Dublin who wanted to remain anonymous has been on it for 18 years. He's been telling us how he struggled with the need for regular urine testing and the need to go to a pharmacy every day to receive it.
I think that the testing is, I think it's being used far too much, and that just too much of an entrenched culture into testing urinalysis and testing in general. I'd like to do the other things that have occurred. I had to attend a pharmacy on the morning of my father's funeral. I missed an examination in college because of it. Again, they wouldn't give me a takeaway dose. And it was just you don't feel as if it's very, very, very difficult to feel as if you're part of it. You can get into employment, education, or anything. You even to leave the country for a week for a holiday. A lot of people, that hasn't happened for in a long, long time.
Well, thanks to him for talking to us this morning. The report was compiled by the Service Users' Rights in Action. It's made up of former service users and medical professionals, and they interviewed 121 people on methadone for the study. Its author, Dr. Richard Healy, joins us now. And Dr. Healy, listening to that user on it for 18 years, is that typical?
It's very much you. It's very much, from our research, it's very much par for the course. We would have over 50% of our clients that we interviewed are on methadone over 15 years.
And how long should they be on it?
Well, that's a non-answerable question. But the reason why we would find that people are on it so long is because we're not anti-methadone. We are asking for accountability from methadone services for the services they are providing, which for us are impossible for people like the man you just had. So the way he spoke is the exact narrative that we are hearing.
Yeah.
That people have been left on methadone for very long periods of time. There's very low, it's very difficult to reintegrate. I mean, I heard him speaking about trying to get back into college, which proves he's trying to reintegrate. And with the obligations that methadone services put upon clients, it's impossible to reintegrate because you have to visit these chemists, you have to visit these, give your analysis. 51% of clients are giving your analysis up to three times a week.
So is there another way?
Is there another way? Yes, we could. Methadone is practiced all over the world. And this isn't exclusive to Ireland, but we do have a very poor record of methadone provision in Ireland. It's been internationally evaluated by two reports, one called the Farrow Report and one called the Priodarchy Report. The Farrow Report reported that our methadone system was entrenched in urinalysis. In other words, like your client, like your guest said, it was all based around urines and testing. There was nothing to do with the client's well-being was brought into it, whereas Priodarchy reported on the poor training of the people who were the professionals who were providing the service.
Richard, we have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I do apologise for that because it's an important topic, but we hopefully will come back to this subject at a later point. Dr. Richard Healy, thank you. It's